Israel's long and secret history of assassination.
The role of Israeli intelligence community in the making of Israeli history, in the making of the history of our region, the Middle East, and sometimes the history of the world, is profound.
That's Ronen Bergman. We talk with him about his book, Rise and Kill First. Then Norman Finkelstein tells us about the impact of Israeli policy on the civilian population of Gaza. His book is Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. My guest Ronen Bergman's book, Rise and Kill First, is an in-depth investigation into possibly the most secret program of the most secretive security apparatus in modern history, Israel's targeted assassination program. The book is a history, Bergman writes, of a long string of impressive tactical successes, but also disastrous strategic failures. He concludes that Israel's assassination program, despite its goal of protecting Israel, has had a corrosive effect on the peace process, as well as the country's democratic institutions. Ronen Bergman is a senior correspondent for military and intelligence affairs for Yedioth Ahronot, Israel's largest daily paid newspaper, and a contributing writer for the New York Times magazine. He's come under attack for Rise and Kill First from many in the Israeli state, but he stands by his findings, the fruit of interviews with some 1,000 sources in Israel's security agencies and government. I started out by asking Ronen Bergman why he decided to tackle this difficult subject. He told me, aside from the challenge of piercing the veil of secrecy and the public's great interest in the story,
but beyond all that, and this is something very specific, I'm saying that as an Israeli, as a Jew, the role of Israeli intelligence community in the making of Israeli history, in the making of the history of our region, the Middle East, and sometimes the history of the world, is profound. The different agencies of Israeli intelligence, both internal, domestic, and external, have taken a primary role in, I think, most, if not all, the main decision-making processes, the main actions, the main carvers of history throughout the last 70 years of Israeli existence as an independent state. And so in order to have a clear and a correct reading of the history of Israel, you need to have a better and much better understanding of the history of Israeli intelligence. So in a way, this book deals with the use of targeted killings and special operations, but this is in fact the history of Israeli Mossad and the other intelligence agencies, and it enables us to have a much, much clearer understanding of why things happen the way they do.
You know, one thing you say in the book that is that it's kind of a fight between two parts of Israel's soul. On the one hand, I mean, my father was a rabbi. I was raised in the Jewish tradition, and it was one always of social justice. That's what being a Jew meant to me. On the other hand, you have a program of targeted assassination. So I wonder if you could talk about this tension of the two in light of what you just said of how we must evaluate Israel's history.
You know, you have mentioned social justice, you have mentioned the Jewish religion, and at the same time, the same religion is also the one who wrote the sentence from which the name of the book is carved. The Babylonian Talmud says, if someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. And that sentence was repeatedly used by many of the interviewees for the book. I have spoken with 1,000 people, prime ministers, minister of defense, chief of staff, chiefs of the Mossad, to intelligence officers, to the actual operatives. And many of them have used that sentence to explain why they did what they had to do. And it was not a justification. They were not trying to defend themselves. They were trying to explain their mindset And that mindset is of a liberal democracy in the Middle East that faces extreme dangers and uses extreme measures to counter that. Now, if you are living in such a country, and on top of everything, you always have at the back of your mind your history. You have the pogroms, you have the persecution of Jews, and you have the Holocaust, of course. And while having that, Israel at every decade was facing some sort of a prime nemesis, a main enemy who called for the destruction, who called and used and tried to destroy Israel. So while being, I think, a liberal democracy, Israel also had that dilemma of how to survive. And of course, that also, once you decide that you are unable, that it's legal and moral to use these tools, like aggressive means of operations, targeted killing, using physical pressure, interrogation, et cetera, then you also face some very serious moral dilemmas.
So let's skip to the 1967 war. I know that there's so much in your book that goes on before then, but there was a critical inflection point. There was some sense after that war that you write about where you say that Israel's victory could, there was a sense in Israel that it could lead to a lasting peace with territorial concessions to the Arabs and the establishment of a separate Palestinian state. What happened to that vision and why?
Well, the territories, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, they were not taken in order to resettle Jews there or to establish parts of Israeli law, to legislate Israeli law on that territory. They were taken as part of war. They were taken because Israel thought that it needs to counter Arab threats. And at the beginning, nobody imagined that Israel is going to control these territories, which are extensively populated by Arabs, by Palestinians, for more than a short while. So people thought, well, maybe we should bargain this for a truthful, ongoing peace with the Arabs. But time passed, and I think what really happened was that the triumphant victory of the Six-Day War led to the false feeling in Israel that it's an empire, that it's an undefeatable empire, and that some sort of a new kingdom of Judea has been established. The Israelis are known to be going across from one extreme to another in terms of mood. And so while just before the war, people thought that the Arabs are going to annihilate Israel, just immediately after, when it was clear that Israel was able to conquer so much land, defeat all the Arab armies in 6 days, and, you know, declare a rapid victory, one of the most glorious in modern history of war, then they flipped and they thought, well, now there's nothing that could defeat us. And that led to some sort of hubris, which didn't leave enough room to the need for diplomacy, statesmanship, discourse with the enemy. And in the short term, it led to the surprise attack of the Arab countries on Israel in 1973, a war which Israel almost lost. And in the long term, I think it led to a mindset of many in Israel that force can be used to address any problem. And in many cases, there's no need to turn for diplomacy, or there's no hope to turn for diplomacy. Look, what is happening now in the Arab world is used, you know, all these bloodshed, the revolution which did not turn into democracy in many countries, the Arab Spring, which many people think turned into an Islamic winter, that is being used as manifestation for many Israelis to say, well, here is a proof that we should not go for diplomacy, because diplomacy will lead us only to evacuation of land and to the establishment of jihadist more territories or countries instead of the geographies that we withdraw from. And the overall perception, the overall lesson that many Israelis drew from the the successful use of war in one hand, but on special operation on the other, and targeted killing, was that at the end of the day, these operations can hold history by its tail. I think it's wrong, by the way. I think that the use of these operations could be very beneficial, and in many cases, it saved the lives of many Israelis. I can point out to some very clear example. And at the end of the day, this cannot stop history, and this would not replace statesmanship and diplomacy.
Well, that's so interesting. And why don't you give us an example of where the targeted killing, you feel, it could be at least justified in the sense of saving many lives?
I can point out on three examples, which I'm going to detail briefly. First, the campaign of targeted killings that the Mossad initiated after the killing of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in 1972. Which is, by the way, a campaign that is viewed in a wrongful way, mainly thanks to the wrongful description of it in the well-known and very interesting movie Munich by Steven Spielberg. Unlike the way that the story is described there, the Mossad didn't kill the people who were behind Munich. The Mossad killed PLO operatives in Europe, which were not connected to that operation at all. But what it did do is to convince Yasser Arafat, the chief of the PLO, and its deputy, Abu Jihad, Khalil al-Wazir, that as long as they continue to work in Europe, they are by far more exposed to Mossad assassins. They pay a significant price in the life of their lieutenants, and they also sustain severe damage to their international prestige in the diplomacy sphere. And what it did was to convince them to stop working in Europe for many, many years, and reconcentrate on the Middle East. Another example is the huge wave of suicide bombers that attacked Israel from early 2001 in a period of time that was later called the Second Intifada. And for a time, these suicide bombers were seemed undefeatable, not just in Israel. You know, how do you stop a person who is willing to die, needs no training, he has the suicide belt with the switch that has only two positions, off and on. He takes the suicide belt, he crossed the border from the occupied territory into Israel, he abort the bus, and he moved the switch from off to on and explodes himself. How do you stop such a person? You threaten him that you kill him, he is willing to die anyway. And the only thing, and hundreds and thousands of close to 1,500 people, and many thousands were killed, and many thousands were wounded during these years because of suicide bombing. And it took time, but at the end of the day, the only thing that was able to stop these people was the extensive use of Israel with targeted killing. They did not target the suicide bombers, the Hamas, the jihadist organization that sent them, said they have boasted that they have more volunteers than suicide belts. But above them in the hierarchy were by far less people. The bomb makers, the recruiters, the indoctrinators, the drivers, the coordinators, the regional commanders, the political leaders, all of these became a target. Now, not all of them were killed, but enough of them were taken out by Israeli campaign of targeted killing, the most extensive ever conducted in history, that Hamas realized that by continuing sending the suicide bombers, they risked the existence, the sole existence of their own organization, and they stopped. And in 2004, 3 years later, they begged on their knees through Egyptian mediation, that Israel would stop killing their people. So that was a significant achievement from Israeli intelligence.
But also, as you point out in your book, Ronan Bergman, in Rise Up and Kill First, that there were other kinds of political fallout. For example, Shimon Peres, who took power after Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, you say that he lost power because of a wave of terrorist attacks after the assassination of the Palestinian militant called the Engineer, one of the bomb makers that you talk about. So what lesson do you draw from this? On the one hand, saving lives in one context, as you say, and on the other, what was the cost?
Well, I think that the lesson that one should draw from that specific incident, and it's not cross-border, meaning there were targeted killing and assassination, that some of them are described in the book, that indeed led to a further outburst of violence that could have been prevented if the assassination wouldn't have taken place. But what you describe, I think, has a very important tactical or strategic lesson. And that is that you never go to kill someone unless you have the ability to counter the revenge, the retaliation that would happen next day. So that person that you describe, 5 years before the era which I just detailed, 1995, the engineer, Yechiel Hayash, was killed. But that was followed by five revenge, retaliation, suicide bombers that didn't just cost the lives of many, many people, but also took down Shimon Peres from being a prime minister and gave the wheel to Benjamin Netanyahu, because Shimon Peres was seen as someone who cannot control the situation and is not firm enough to fight terrorism. The truth was that it was the Israeli intelligence who didn't have the ability. They did very well from their point of view in killing one operative, but they didn't know how to stop his followers when they were seeking for revenge.
Right. And talking about revenge, on the other side, just before that, the Rabin assassination, the Shin Bet was totally taken by surprise when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by a right-wing, ultra-religious Israeli Jew. Talk about this. Why was the Shin Bet so taken by surprise?
They never thought that a Jew would kill the prime minister. This was just out of the scope of their plausible scenarios. In fact, Yitzhak Rabin had the chief of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad killed just something like a month before that, in October of 1995. And the Shin Bet, who were in charge of the security of the prime minister, during that demonstration for peace at the central rally in Tel Aviv, they were afraid of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad perpetrators to come into the rally and kill Israeli prime minister. So they were looking for people, Palestinians or Arabs, but they saw a young Jewish man of Yemenite origin who was standing there, and they didn't pay any attention, because the scenario, the possibility that a Jew would even think of killing the Israeli prime minister didn't occur to them. This was so unbelievable. And everybody in Israel who lived that day remember where they were when it was announced that Yitzhak Rabin was killed by a Jew. And the fact that there are people in the extreme right in Israel who do not respect the law, who prefer what they see as the religious oath, who are able to conduct terrorism against Jews and Arabs in order to fulfill what they think is the will of the Lord, of God. It did not end that day, that horrible day on the 4th of November, 1995. It exists until today. And I think that the Shin Bet is extremely capable when it fights Palestinian terrorism. I'm not sure they are that capable when they need to fight Jews.
And we're talking with Ronan Bergman about his book, Rise Up and Kill. And as you point out, it continues to today. I mean, Netanyahu followed Shimon Peres, and he was a hardliner. Then there was Ehud Barak, who put forth some peace efforts. So you've had a kind of going back and forth of hardliners and liberals until, really, Netanyahu now has been in power for quite some years. How many years has he been prime minister?
Netanyahu has been 3 years, so from 1996 until 1998, and then again from 2009 until today. He is an excellent, by far, I think, the best politician campaigner in Israel, and with the best understanding of the feeling of the masses, of his voters. He understands the political scene better than anyone, and he has, I think, as time progressed, as time passed, he has changed. And from a certain point, he had nothing but one goal set forth, and that is to stay the prime minister. And for the time being, I think that he believes that his way to stay the prime minister is to promote a right-wing agenda. And this is why we see Israel, the many, many years since he has become, again, the prime minister, adopting a right-wing agenda, and that he is very persistent with having a right-wing coalition member.
And do you think things are changed now for him? What do you think his prospects are after he's now been connected directly to the corruption investigation?
I think he's done. I think that sooner than later, he would need to step down. The latest developments in the investigation have broadened its scope much, much further than just the case of the alleged bribe when he and his wife received cigars and pink champagne in exchange for some benefits they gave to a billionaire. Now they're talking about the much, much deeper and more corrupt cases. They have few state witnesses, and it seems to me that Netanyahu will be indicted. For the time being, he was not indicted. This was just the police investigation conclusions and recommendation to indict him. But it's still up to the attorney general to decide whether to do that or not. So at the end of the day, I think that in the next 4 to 6 months, we will see a decision of the attorney general, Avichai Mandelblit, to indict him, after which parts of the coalition, not his party, but other parties, will depart and the government will fall. This will still enable Netanyahu to call for new elections and seek the support of the people. But I think it's too late for him. I think that he has ended his political career. He will not go away without a fight, but I think it's done.
I'd like to spend the rest of the time we have. You've talked about how the targeted assassinations have saved lives, Israeli lives, but you also lay out the costs. And I'd like to talk some more about some of the social costs, because you spoke of Israel as a liberal democracy. And I think we can see that, you know, where the prime minister can be investigated, that certainly is some indication of democratic norms having some sway. But what has been the impact on Israel's nature as a liberal democracy of having such a profoundly important role of these secret intelligence agencies that have operated without oversight?
Well, of course, once you have an intelligence community that works according to a different protocol and according to a different law, sometimes the law is not written and sometimes it's secret. And that law, these regulations enable the intelligence community and the military and the special forces to do things that are not permitted to a regular citizen, such as killing a person, you know, the most severe offense in the criminal code. Then you get a very problematic situation. I must say that it did not spill to the society of Israel in the sense that the people who were involved in targeted killings on behalf of the state, except for very few cases, I can recall two or three, didn't, when they retired, started to kill people on a personal level. Yet, of course, it creates a very difficult situation on morality, on legality. What it also did was that it gave the intelligence community a primary role in the decision-making process, sometimes by far more important than they should have been given, in the sense that there should have been more civilians involved. And the civilians, as much as they were, meaning the ministers, were either not very much informed about what exactly is happening, or they were former military intelligence, so basically the same people, just, you know, a little older after they retired, but it's coming from the same school of thought. So there were not a lot of people in that decision-making process who had the ability and the status to stop and say, well, maybe we can do it differently. Maybe we don't need to use that kind of force. And also, because of the success, I think that the Israeli intelligence community is arguably the best one in the world. And they were very successful. Sooner or later, they were able to provide Israeli leaders with solution to most, if not all, the challenges that they were posed with. But that also led the leaders to think that this is not just a mean, the special operation, targeted killing, pinpoint targets beyond enemy lines. This is not just the solution for tactical problems, but this is also the best solution for any strategic difficulty that they might counter. It's much easier to order the killing of a person or the destruction of a building or the implanting of computer viruses than to start a tedious, Sisyphic political negotiation with your adversary. But the Israeli leaders thought that this sometimes it replaces it, and in that sense, they were wrong.
So my final question is, do you think Israel would have been in a more secure place at this point, in a position of greater peace and security, if it had practiced less of targeted assassinations and more of diplomacy?
Yes and no. I think that in general, as I said, the use of targeted killings in many cases proved to be effective. I leave to your audience and hopefully to the readers of my book to judge whether this is legal and moral. Is it legally and morally justified to use this means? But on the realm, on the question of effectiveness, after 8 years of researching this book, the answer is yes, it is effective in many of the cases, not all of them, of course. But was it sufficient? No. It should have been followed by diplomacy. It should not replace diplomacy. It should be the step before diplomacy. I mentioned before the targeted assassination campaign that was launched in order to counter suicide bombers in the Second Intifada. Now, Israel was successful. They defeated suicide bombers. They were the first one, and I think the only intelligence agency in the world that was able to do that. And that led to a time of peace, relative peace, between Israel and Palestinian Authority. That should be the time where diplomacy should have been adopted. That should be the time where Israel should have been very, very energetic, trying to reach a truthful reconciliation with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, and his prime minister, Salim Fayyad. And that, for various reasons, did not happen.
Ronan Bergman. His book is Rise Up and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. It's out from Random Penguin House. Next up, we turn to the devastating impact of Israeli military policy on civilians in the Gaza Strip. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On March 30th, Israeli forces fired on a crowd of thousands of unarmed Palestinian protesters, killing 17 and wounding more than 1,400. The Palestinians were demonstrating at the fence border of the Israeli-blockaded Gaza Strip, asking for a right of return to the villages and towns where their families lived before 1948, when Israel expelled them. My guest, Norman Finkelstein, has written 10 books, most of which have centered on Israeli policy toward the Palestinian people. He's been a fierce critic of that policy, well before others began to speak out against it. His latest book is Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. It was recently published by the University of California Press. Norman Finkelstein, welcome to Writer's Voice. Your book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom, is really a remarkable dive deep into the humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. It's been described as an open-air prison, the Strip. It's among the most densely populated places in the world. More than two-thirds of its inhabitants are refugees, more than half under 18 years of age. Tell us just briefly, what are the current conditions in which the Palestinians in Gaza are living before we go into some of the history of how this came about?
Well, Gaza has been under an Israeli siege blockade in its current phase since January 2006, after Hamas, the Islamic organization, won parliamentary elections. And this brutal and illegal blockade, because it constitutes a form of collective punishment, its effects were exacerbated by Israel's successive military assaults on Gaza, the three main ones being Operation Cast Lead in December 2008 through January 2009, Operation Pillar of Defense, November 2012, and then Operation Cast Lead, July-August 2014. After each of these really devastating military assaults, Gaza was not able to rebuild because of the blockade. So now you have the effects of an illegal, inhuman blockade compounded by periodic military assaults, which have caused monumental death and destruction, from which Gaza is unable to rebuild after each of the assaults. And now we've reached the point of the bitter fruit of this inhuman and criminal Israeli policy. So human rights organizations and international relief organizations and Israel itself are now saying that Gaza is on the verge of imploding, that Gaza is on the verge, if not already crossed the point, of being unlivable. So, for example, 95% of Gaza's drinking water is contaminated and unfit for human consumption. So on a daily basis, each time a child in Gaza, the 1 million children who are caged in Gaza, drinks a glass of water, he or she is poisoning themselves.
These are terrible conditions. And you write in this book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom, that the book isn't so much about Gaza, but about what has been done to it, some of which you've begun to describe here. You say that Gaza is about a big lie composed of a thousand little lies. What is that big lie?
Well, the big lie is, first of all, that Gaza is the aggressor in the periodic conflicts that erupt between the periodic armed conflicts that erupt between Israel and Gaza. And number two, that Gaza constitutes a threat, let alone an existential threat to Israel. The facts are, number one, and speaking broadly, all the conflicts, armed conflicts, between Israel and Gaza were initiated by Israel. And number two, Gaza poses no military threat to Israel. It doesn't even have any weapons to speak of. All of these claims are contrived by Israel and then repeated obediently by a compliant and complicit mainstream media. But the whole premise is completely preposterous that Israel in these targeted assassinations is reacting to a threat. The only threat that the Palestinians have posed has been the threat to resolve the conflict, which is what the Israeli political scientist Avner Yaniv called the Palestinian peace offensive. Every time the Palestinians threaten to resolve the conflict peacefully and diplomatically, Israel panics because it fears international pressure will be brought to bear on it to solve the conflict. And Israel doesn't want to solve the conflict because the only basis for solving it would have to be an Israeli withdrawal, which they don't accept. So they periodically launch these offensives, as they did in the case that Avner Yaniv was referring to. In June 1982, they attacked Lebanon not because of a threat, let alone an existential threat posed by Israel, but because the Palestinians, its leadership, had made clear that it supports a two-state settlement on the 1967 borders. And that was, as Avner Yaniv called it, another one of those dreadful Palestinian peace offensives. The idea that Israel is doing these things in self-defense is one of those ludicrous claims which are very popular on the Upper East Side, but in the real world have no connection with reality.
You mentioned the Palestinian drive towards peace, and in 1993 and then in 1995, the Oslo Accords were brokered between Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin. You know, the frame that I've heard over and over from other members of my family, and I'm Jewish, and from other fellow Jews, is that it was the Palestinians who sabotaged the Oslo Accords. I wonder if you could address that.
Well, first of all, the Oslo Accords were not sabotaged. The Oslo Accords achieved their goal. The Oslo Accords were remarkably successful, and one has to credit Israel with having anticipated and predicted with, I would say, impressive insight how the Oslo Accords would unfold. So the background to the Oslo Accords was the First Intifada that began in December 7, 1987. The First Intifada was a public relations debacle for Israel as international opinion was outraged at Israel's brutal assault on the Palestinian nonviolent resistance. At that point, Yitzhak Rabin, he was defense minister, but later became prime minister. During the Intifada, he was the one that ordered what was called the force, might, and beatings policy, which was to beat up the Palestinian children to break their bones, as he put it. He said this was a humane policy because we were not killing them, the children. We were just breaking their bones. And then after this First Intifada, the Israeli leadership reached the conclusion that it would no longer be able to maintain the occupation in the current manner. First of all, it was very bad public relations for Israel to be seen beating up little children, throwing stones. And secondly, the army, which was designed for wars, was now bogged down in the West Bank engaging in civil actions that was worthy more of a police force. So the Israeli leadership, in particular Rabin, decided to rationalize the occupation by replacing the Israeli occupation forces with a domestic or indigenous security force. And the security force they recruited, they hired in order to do the dirty work which had sullied their name, they hired the PLO to do the dirty work. And the truth be told, it worked perfectly. The Palestinian leadership got all these what are called VIP privileges. They got all sorts of bribes, which they put away into their Swiss bank accounts. And the Palestinian security forces were trained by Jordan and the CIA. And now they're a very efficient totalitarian police force repressing the Palestinians. And now Israel's name has been cleansed because all of the torture, all of the beatings, all of the killings are done by and large by the Palestinian security forces. And so seen from the vantage point of what Israel's goal was, namely to rationalize the occupation so that the dirty work is now done by an indigenous force, and the army can go about its job, which is to train for future wars, not chase little children down the Kasbah in Nablus. From the vantage point of Israel, Oslo was a huge success.
You mentioned the PLO. In, 2006, Hamas came into power in a democratically held election. I wonder if you could talk about the PLO and Hamas, and then I'm going to ask you about the Israeli response to that democratic election of Hamas.
Well, the Palestinian people had tired of the corruption and the false promises of the PLO. And so, not so much because they embraced Hamas ideology, but more as a protest vote. And also because at that point, Hamas was relatively not corrupt. They elected Hamas into office in January 2006 in what was then the first democratic election in the Arab world, and which was certified as democratic, among others, by Jimmy Carter, who was present at the occasion. Oh, and at that point, the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, like every Arab dictatorship, once it gets into power, doesn't want to leave power and has this sense of entitlement. And so they didn't want to relinquish power. And then they colluded with the U.S. administration and Israel to overthrow Hamas. And in 2007, Hamas foiled the coup attempt and sent the PA packing back to the West Bank.
So that was in 2007. In 2008, Israel began Operation Cast Lead, which you mentioned before. And you say that aside from deterrence, which was what the Israelis claimed it was for, and maybe you can explain that term, you say it was to fend off, quote, Palestinian pragmatism. So what were the reasons why Israel began Operation Cast Lead? What was the deterrence, and what was that pragmatism on the part of the Palestinians?
Well, I've already discussed the pragmatism, the fact that the Palestinians periodically embrace the two-state settlement, which always poses a problem and evokes dread in Israel because it fears that if Palestinians openly embrace the two-state settlement, diplomatic pressure will be put on Israel to also embrace it and withdraw from the territories it illegally occupies, namely the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. The other main factor in the Israeli assaults has been after Israel suffered a major defeat in Lebanon in 2006, the Israelis feared that the Arabs would no longer feel threatened by Israel. And so it had to restore what it calls its deterrence capacity. And deterrence capacity is just a fancy technical term for the Arab world's fear of us meaning Israel. Now, Israel did not want to tangle again with the Hezbollah as it did in Lebanon in 2006. So it looked around for an easy target to show the Arab world that the Israeli killing machine was still well-greased and well-capable of inflicting massive death and destruction. And so it chose Gaza to teach Hezbollah a lesson. It chose to murder and destroy in Gaza in order to restore its deterrence capacity in the Arab world.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Norman Finkelstein about his new book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom.
So what about the notion of blame on both sides? I mean, there certainly have been suicide bombers. There has been terrorism on the part of, Palestinians. There have been rockets that have been fired.
Well, let's take your last example. So you say blaming both sides. Let's see. During Operation Protective Edge, 550 Palestinian children were killed. One Israeli child was killed, ratio 550-1. 18,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed. One Israeli home was destroyed, ratio 18,000-1. And now your listeners will have to decide for themselves whether, given that balance sheet, whether the expression both sides suffered accurately depicts what transpired during Operation Protective Edge. Now let's look at these rockets, as they're called. Hamas fired 5,000 rockets and 2,000 mortar shells, altogether 7,000 projectiles at Israel. Of those 5,000 rockets, as they're called, one Israeli home was destroyed. One. So now you have, so to speak, a conundrum. How could it be that 5,000 rockets only managed to destroy one home? That doesn't sound very credible, believable. If I were shooting 5,000 rockets, knowing nothing about rockets, and even if the rockets were lacking in a guidance system, you would think 5,000 rockets, even if fired by somebody as inept as myself, would destroy more than one home. Well, Israel's answer, of course, is Iron Dome. It claims to have a very sophisticated anti-missile defense system. But by Israel's own admission, Iron Dome was only deployed around the major cities, and altogether, Iron Dome was targeted, or only 820 of the Hamas rockets came within the vicinity of Iron Dome. Israel claims Iron Dome deflected 740 of those rockets. The anti-missile specialist at MIT, Theodore Postol, says the figure was probably closer to 40, not 740. But even if we accept the Israeli figure of 740, we're still left with the perplexing situation that at least 4,260 rockets entered Israel and only one house was destroyed. How could that be? Well, the answer is pretty obvious, because those are not rockets. They're just enhanced fireworks. There was no Hamas rockets, just as there were no Hamas terror tunnels, just as there was, if you believe the anti-missile specialist at MIT, Theodore Postol, there was no Iron Dome. These are all just media fictions, which are dutifully repeated, not just by Israel's defenders, but by Israel's critics, because unbeknownst to themselves, they're just repeating Israeli propaganda.
Well, there's now an International Criminal Court probe over Operation Protective Edge, and Norman Finkelstein, in your book, Gaza, an Inquest into Its Martyrdom, you not only criticize the Israelis and the Palestinian authorities, but also the human rights organizations. So I'd like to ask you, well, actually to go back a little bit to the Goldstone Report of 2009, and then we'll come back to the International Criminal Court. Tell us about the Goldstone Report and what happened to it.
The Goldstone Report came out after Operation Cast Lead in December 2007 through January 2008. It was commissioned by the UN Human Rights Council, and it was headed up by Richard Goldstone, who was a recognized authority on international law. He was a proudly Jewish individual, and he was also a proudly Zionist individual. These are all terms that he used himself to identify himself. And his conclusion from this very weighty report, it ran to many hundreds of pages, his conclusion was that Israel had launched Operation Cast Lead to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Now, that was a critical finding, because he was in effect saying that this was not a war, if by war you mean the targeting of your enemy's military sites and combatants. This was state terrorism. It was a crime against humanity, because its purpose was to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. And that's a, so to speak, horse of a totally different color. We're not talking about a war. We're talking about state terrorism. Israel reacted in fury, indignation, outrage. The whole of Israeli society rose up as if one, from one end of the political spectrum to the other, at all levels of society, to condemn Goldstone. He came under tremendous, brutal, professional and personal attack, which climaxed publicly when he was being denied the right to attend his grandson's bar mitzvah in South Africa. At some point in 2011, April 1st, as it happens, April Fool's Day, it felt almost as if it were a prank. Goldstone published an op-ed piece in the Washington Post retracting his report, and in effect, it transmitted a warning to any of Israel's other high-profile critics, namely, if you mess with Israel, we're going to destroy you. Goldstone claimed that he retracted the report because new information had become available exonerating Israel, but that was a easily demonstrable lie. And I spend a full chapter in the book going through all of Mr. Goldstone's allegedly new information and showing that there was no new information. The most likely interpretation of what happened, but one which can't be proved, and the secret will go with him, presumably to his grave, was that Goldstone was blackmailed into recanting his report.
So what has been the impact? I mean, this is, as you have said, a warning to other critics of Israel. You go on in this book, In Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom, Norman Finkelstein, you go on to examine the record of the human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Talk about that and talk about, do you think that what happened to the Goldstone report was part of the story as to why their criticisms have become muted?
The results of the blackmailing of Goldstone were there for everybody to see after Operation Protective Edge in 2014, which was quantitatively much worse than any of Israel's prior operations. And nonetheless, although Operation Cast Lead was followed by some 300 human rights reports, after Operation Protective Edge, you could count on the fingers of your two hands the total number of human rights reports that were issued. If you take, for example, Human Rights Watch, they published 5 substantial reports after Operation Cast Lead, and they published 1 measly, forgettable report after Operation Protective Edge. The only organizations that weighed in substantially were Amnesty International, which published 5 reports, and the UN Human Rights Council, which published a report. But the Amnesty and Human Rights Council reports were complete whitewashes for Israel. They were a disgrace, and I devote a large number of pages into documenting the accumulation of falsehoods and whitewashing that the Amnesty reports and Human Rights Council report engaged in.
Norman Finkelstein. He's the author of 10 books, including Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict and his latest, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.